Good evening. Hello. Thanks. Yeah, very good evening to you. I hope you're having a pleasant holiday, if you are on holiday. Boxing Day, as we call it in England. So we're going to just start straight away with the consecration, and then we'll get going on the fifth of our Yamas. If you remember, we've been looking at the Yamas. It's been a couple of weeks, had a bit of a break, went home, came back, and here I am. So just to get going with the consecration, we're just going to settle into wherever you are. So just relaxing down through the feet or through the base of the spine, feeling the shoulders relax and the face become soft. And then just noticing if you've slouched over at all. So just correcting for that and straightening the spine, reaching the crown towards the sky or the ceiling. And beginning to take some breaths. So we're just moving the mind within. Sense of moving into our heart space, wherever that is for you. Maybe it's the center of the chest, or maybe it's far lower in the gut, or maybe it's all the way down in your feet. And then just breathing into that space, sort of opening that area up and connecting to that part. And from this place, we're going to just make an offering of our time together this evening. May it be beneficial for all beings. May our time together serve others. May everyone be happy. May everyone be free from misery. May no one ever be separated from their happiness. May everyone have equanimity, be free from hatred and detachment. And we'll take a deep inhale. And exhale, letting it go. Okay, so I have a note saying if I could, I'm a bit soft on the mic. So I just wanted to check, is that still the case? Let's just type it's in the room, sorry, bear with me. Waiting for an answer to see if I need to reboot my mic. Anyone? Okay, I'm not getting a response. The mic's working. Okay. Right, I'm not getting anything here at all. Okay, then bear with me. I'm going to have to log out as I'm not hearing from anyone and log back in. Okay. No, I know. Oh, there they go. No, you said it was too quiet. So I tried to amend it, but then it seemed as if there was no one listening. So I thought maybe I'd been locked out of the room. Is this any better? Oh, okay. Oh, right. Okay. All right. Then, what do you, shall I start? Oh, okay. Right. So, okay, well, I'll just start again. I don't know if maybe you want to stop recording and then start again and we'll just get going. Any clues? No. All right then. Well, I'll just talk. One of those days. Okay. All right then. So this week we're going to talk about the final of our yamas, an interesting one, a parigraha. So a parigraha. I'm just going to type that in. So we've been talking about the yamas, these sort of guidances for yoga. They're like the Ten Commandments or the Ten Commitments, I suppose. And this one is called a parigraha. It's number 5. I'm just type that in, a parigraha. And it has many meanings, as they all do. They're all this, you know, just one Sanskrit word that can be unpacked. And then sort of the meaning sort of interpreted or felt as you sort of delve into it. And so one of the translations is non-possessiveness. Another would be non-attachment. But there's a real strong sense in a parigraha around this sort of clinging and grasping. So I like to think of it as non-grasping. And it's really sort of encapsulated in stories of how monkeys are trapped in Southeast Asia. I feel like this sort of embodies what a parigraha is. So in Southeast Asia, there's this way of trapping a monkey, and hunters or poachers or whoever's, people just trying to move the monkeys along. I don't know if, why they're doing it, but they take a coconut and then carve a hole in the top and take out the insides of the coconut. And then they put like a tasty treat, like a piece of fruit, in deep inside the coconut. And then they take the coconut and put it up in a tree in such a way that it can't really be dislodged. And so a monkey comes along and it sees the bit of fruit inside the coconut, and it reaches its hand in through the small hole that's been carved in the top, and then grabs the fruit inside, turning his little hand into a fist. And when he does that, he cannot get his hand out of the coconut. And monkeys have not figured out that they should let go and be free. They just keep this little fist as tightly as they can, holding on to this morsel of fruit, and cannot get it out of the coconut. And eventually that's how the poachers catch them. And there's also a story of in India, I'm told, that the way that some monkeys are captured is that they put a banana inside of a cage and the monkey's outside of the cage. And the monkey reaches its hand in, grabs the banana, and then cannot get its hand out with the banana. So it just carries holding on to this banana, even though it's completely free. It's not even in the cage, the monkey. It is essentially trapped by this clinging, this desperate clinging to this banana, this thing of desire. So to me, that sort of really sort of epitomizes what a parigraha is all about, and this sort of clinging and grasping that we do in our lives. And it asks us to sort of look at that and see if we can sort of let go, essentially. And it's really a practice of letting go. And another way I like to think about sort of as an example, like a tangible example when we're looking at a parigraha, is the breath. So that the breath, you know, it's something very natural and it comes easily without us even knowing. and we hold the breath, and if we hold the breath for too long, it turns toxic. So it's this sort of idea of like when we start to hold on desperately to something, it actually can sort of be very detrimental for us. And indeed, the importance of the breath is sort of echoed throughout yogic teachings and many teachings. And it's this idea that, just as an aside really, that the breath is part of us that sort of moves without us controlling it. And we breathe all day long, and often we don't even notice how often we're breathing or that we're breathing at all. There's like an intelligence that's just breathing without our mind having to do it. But it's also something that we can engage the mind in and mentally control.
control the breath, move the breath, observe the breath,
take deeper breaths. So it's like this one sort of gateway of where the conscious mind and the unconscious mind can play. And that's why the breath is so important for the yogis and they think about it. So Parigraha really is this practice of letting go, of allowing, and stopping holding and clinging on to. And this sort of knowledge that when we hold on in that sort of clasping, we really lose our freedom like the monkeys, and we trap ourselves in this sort of false existence. So taken to the very fullest expression, it's actually would be called vairagya. I'm just going to write that in. It's V-A-I-R-A-G-Y-A, I think. I think I've got that right. Vairagya. And that's the Sanskrit word for like detachment. Detachment. And that would be like a parigraha in its fullest. They're not quite the same, but if you were to practice complete letting go, in the end, you would reach this vairagya. So vairagya is the path that India's holy men, the sadhus, take when they leave all worldly things behind and they go off into the forests and they begin this life of austerity and take nothing with them. And they normally switch to like an orange clothing so people know they're a sadhu. And their final step before they leave to go into the forest is actually that they attend their own funeral, which blows my mind. They have completely let go of even themselves, which we'll come to later. So the path of a parigraha really is a very gentle one, as we'll see, but ultimately the goal is almost vairagya, to let go completely of this notion of self. And I was thinking earlier that this sort of reminded me of the pilgrims that make the Hajj. So the Hajj is the 5-day pilgrimage that millions of Muslims make to Mecca each year. And in preparing for the Hajj, a pilgrim must first repay all debts and then go around and ask forgiveness from all relatives and friends that they've hurt, that they may have caused knowingly or unknowingly. They just ask forgiveness from everyone. They make sure that all dependents are provided for while they're away making this pilgrimage. And then the pilgrim leaves behind all attachments, let go of all desires and wealth, and dressed only in these sort of these white unhemmed clothes, which are used for burial. So very much like the sadhus, they make this journey as if preparing for death. And it just kind of reminds me of this when we start to take a step on the yamas of the parigraha. That's essentially what we're doing is this pilgrimage where we're surrendering ourselves completely. And we start the pilgrimage with this notion of letting go of everything. And I guess parigraha sort of prepares us for that step of letting go of everything. So as we talked about before, yamas are about relationship with the world. And the niyamas that will follow this in the next sort of 5 weeks or so are more about sort of delving inside and going within and working with the self, like the big self, and discovering like the love that we are or the light that we are or the truth that we are. Whereas these yamas is really sort of about giving up the facade of what we think we are. And then we get to make this step into the niyamas. So a parigraha, especially, you know, as I mentioned earlier in some of this series, there was no sort of coincidence there was good reason why each of the yamas was in the position they're in. And this parigraha, as I say, is the end of all the yamas. We've had ahimsa and satya, and now it's finally sort of letting go so that we can then begin to move into the self. So it's almost like that beginning phase of what the pilgrim is doing before Mecca, before they go to Mecca on the Hajj, that sort of going around and letting go of everything so that they can then step deeply into self. This really, really beautiful yama. But we're trying to sort of look at these yamas as a way of sort of, you know, how can we embody them in our daily lives? How can we practice them? So how do we start to let go, and what exactly are we letting go of initially? So one key in working with a parigraha is to really start to observe desires. Excuse me, I'm just having some tea. So the Bhagavad Gita says that we come back life after life after life because we have these unfulfilled desires. So whenever there is a desire or an attachment, which, you know, similar things really, there's a desire there, we have to come back and be born into another life to fulfill that desire. But the problem, of course, with that is that more and more desires keep popping up. And maybe eventually all those desires will have gone and then we'll be ready to be spiritual students. But more often than not, just one more desire emerges. So even if we have a deep desire to be wealthy, it doesn't happen in this lifetime. Next lifetime, we'll come back, try again and again. And maybe one day we'll come back and we'll be millionaires. And the next time we may want to be billionaires, and so it goes on and on and on and on. And we all know this sort of feeling of always wanting more. So, and I remember Regina talking about desires once, and I don't want to butcher this story, but she mentioned that when we desire something, like, I don't know, like getting a new car or brunch or something, that when we get it for a moment, there is like a real peace that comes over us, and it's actually not the brunch or the car, but that peaceful feeling is actually the no longer wanting something. It's that lack of desire. So when we're practicing aparigraha, we're really trying to get familiar with this essence of desire. What is it? Is it the thing itself? Is it something underlying the object itself? What is the nature of that feeling? And what does it really feel like? And when you start to delve into when you're really sort of like clawing for something and you really, really want it to a point where if you were the monkey and the banana, you wouldn't be letting go either of that banana. You can start to feel a real restless quality emerge to desire. So it's often something we're really attracted to, but at the same time, we're pushing away something else. It's like a bit of a dual quality going on when there's desire. So for example, maybe the monkey has this real strong attraction to the banana. But at the same time, maybe there is like a fear going on of not eating. Maybe that's taking a step too far for a monkey. But say for us, perhaps, maybe we really desire a banana. But at the same time, maybe that desire for a banana is coupled with the one time when we had a banana and we felt really good and we desperately want to get that feeling back. Or maybe it's that the person who's holding up the banana, we don't want them to say no to us because a no means so much more and we wouldn't be able to look at ourselves if we had this no. So often when you start to look into desire, it's really quite murky and a bit uncomfortable, and there's a feeling within it. You can feel like a restlessness going on. So it's very interesting when you start to observe desires, you see, like, you begin to see like a tone or a quality to them. So for example, I was thinking about my feelings this holiday season. So my partner and I are trying for a baby, and we've been trying a while. So recently I saw a nutritionist to see if she could offer me some tips of, you know, what I might change in my diet that might, you know, help in any way. And so she gave me sort of very strict guidelines of things I should and shouldn't be eating. And so I noticed that ever since she said this, I have never really cared about food. I just eat or I don't eat. I'm not one of those people who, you know, I don't care what restaurant we go to. I really don't care if my food's late. It's just not important. I've always been very neutral about food. But all of a sudden, I've started to feel like this tension inside of me. If I'm going somewhere and I feel like the food I'm going to be eating isn't going to be in accordance with these guidelines that the nutritionist has set for me, and there's like a real like desire of me for, I'm having like, I really want to go to Whole Foods and buy all this really healthy food, and it's something that's very alien to me because I've never really cared about that kind of thing, and I can feel like a real tension. And really underlying that is not necessarily this desire for, you know, a beet salad or whatever it is I'm supposed to eat that day. It's really that there's this desire for a baby. And there's like a sadness about that not being there, and a fear that that would happen unless I have this healthy diet. And it all sort of becomes confused, and I can see that it's a lot of mind has crept in, that really, like, now food for me has become like a mind issue. So it's really interesting when you start to delve into your desires that you can begin to feel out, even physically, when they start to come up for you, whether they feel good or they feel restrictive. Also, there's like a control element to desires. If we you know, feel like, well, if I go and do this, then I can control the situation, which is certainly, you know, how I'm feeling about food and fertility. So it's just, you know, it's kind of a paragraph of, as a first step, just invites us to have a deep look at the things we feel tense about if we're not getting or if we're getting too much of. And beginning to just sort of loosen our grip on those by observing them. And normally in the act of observation, the grip sort of begins to loosen a little bit. And because often we realize that it's not the thing that we do really want, or we don't really want in some cases. You know, often once we start to sort of delve into desire, we realize actually we just want the desire to go. We're not even bothered about the thing at the end. So I was trying to think of an example, and it is what it is, this example, if there's anyone I can think of. But I remember in my mid-30s, I'm 39 now, in my mid-30s, I started to get a lot of wrinkles all of a sudden. I'd lived pretty hard in my 20s, I suppose, I don't know. But it really bothered me. And every day I'd look in the mirror and I just, you know, no matter how much I meditated and prayed and tried to, you know, convince myself that it wasn't important, it still really bothered me. And in the end, I realized it wasn't that I needed to get rid of these wrinkles or change myself in any way. It was that the desire itself just was driving me mad, and I just wanted that constant voice to leave. And I think that's a really beautiful step in the path of a parigraha, where you begin to look at your desires and then come to this conclusion that really it's, you just want the desire to go. What you really would like is to be neutral, is to be like equanimous. So you just, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I eat healthily today or I don't eat healthily today. It doesn't matter. I would just, you know, it's all good. it doesn't matter, you know, that I have more wrinkles than this person. It's all good. And not in an all good, I'm just convincing myself it's all good kind of way. But really, like, feeling this neutrality, because there is no judgment, no desire, and none of that. I'm trying to run away from this, and I'm running towards this kind of thing going on. So, and the challenge with desires in general is, of course, that they come in many, many forms. So we tend to think about them first off in the grossest form, and this is how we look at all the yamas. So on the most gross level, we think about desires of the stuff, all the material stuff. So the first step is really to look at, you know, what are we clinging to materially? Let's look around us in our homes and take a good look. Like, what is it that we think we can't live without? What is really gripping us? And if it's not stuff in our homes, is it the job? Or is it that first cup of coffee in the morning? I've talked about this before, like not being able to get through the day without this cup of coffee. Like, are there things that are really have become very important to us that we've sort of made into these false idols, as it were? So just sort of beginning to look at that in our lives. Are there certain routines that we need to do every day? Are we gripping onto those? Can we sort of begin to just look at why that is? And we're not saying you have to give any of this up. The yamas have a lot of space in them. It's more like just start to look a bit more deeply about where your mind is controlling you, rather than you sort of being able to sort of let things flow through you. So in addition to the stuff, it's also people. So parigraha and yoga in particular, your yoga as a whole, really asks us to sort of look at, you know, are we do we believe people are ours? Do we talk about, you know, my brother, my sister, my partner, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, my wife, my husband, my child, and my dog? And it sort of asks us or invites us really just to look at why do we say that? What do we do? What kind of energy does that bring? And of course, it's much easier in the world we live in to just use those terms, but sort of unpacking under it, you know, what are we really saying there? So we talked a bit about Tantra last time we were together when we were looking at Brahmacharya. And there's something in the Tantra teachings with regard to relationships that looks at a parigraha. When I was just come off the back of a couple of months with my school in Thailand, I had this real sort of desire, I guess, to deeply understand, you know, break through jealousy and begin to understand that a partner is not mine. It's not mine to have. So when I came back to New York, I made sort of a concerted effort to find someone who could practice this with me. So I met somebody who was polyamorous, and that wasn't my intention. I am. But I thought it'd be great for me to be with someone who was not that way inclined, who actually liked multiple partners. Because it would help me, and I guess it sounds, I mean, I obviously liked him as well. I wasn't just doing this for a yoga practice. It was kind of just sort of serendipity that we met at this time that I was wanted to practice this. I specifically remember, you know, going on the first few dates with this gentleman, and he would talk about his other partners. He liked to talk about his ex-partners a lot. And I remember feeling like, that tension come up inside my body, and then being able just to sort of see how long it lasted and see if I could just loosen it up a little just by observing it and seeing what happened. And there was a real breakthrough at this one point where we had a date arranged, and he called me up and he said, "Oh, hi, I know we have a date and I really do want to see you, but would you be able to change your schedule? Because there is someone else and I've been trying to get a date with them for a really long time and our schedules haven't worked. And the only day she can do is this Wednesday when you and I are supposed to meet. But is there any way you can do Thursday and then I can go out with her on Wednesday?" And I could feel like this habit arising of this, like, what the hell? Like, what do you think you're doing? You know, you're supposed to be mine, come up. And I suddenly thought, well, I like this person and they're really looking forward to going out with this other person and it's going to bring them a lot of joy. And so why would I, when I have Thursday free, why would I ever not just make that very simple change? And so I just quickly said, oh, absolutely, that's no problem at all. And the minute I said it, I just felt like this huge relief. Like something just left me or expanded and more energy came in. It was like a real shift that just being able to let go of this person is mine kind of mentality. And it was really the beginning of a lot of learning within that relationship. And it lasted quite some time, actually. And in the end, it was so beautiful because he would talk about his ex-partners and I would feel like they were my ex-partners too. I really enjoyed hearing all of them and sort of hearing about this love there was. So it's a really, really, I mean, if you're prepared to go that far, it can be a really beautiful practice. And I'm just seeing this message. I can go over a bit. Okay, great. Thanks. So... So like breaking our, or just observing our desires to stuff, observing the me and the mine and this sort of control or the grip we have over people, this possessiveness. Remember, it's also non-possessiveness that a parigraha means. And then on the more subtle levels, it's about the emotions and the thoughts and opinions and labels and ideas that we have. Can we let go of those? And that can be really sort of the hardest work. That's where we can do a lot a lot of the deep dive on a parigraha, because they're very subtle and we don't notice them. So things like, you know, holding on to our opinions about things. So my opinion, obviously, in the example I just gave, had prior to that been that, you know, if you're with someone, you should be with someone and just one person. And being able to let go of that opinion that really, I mean, who says that? Why is that true? For some people, that's a preference, but it's not really necessarily true. There's no universal law that says that is to be the case. So it's beginning to sort of just observe, you know, why do we think this is right and this is wrong? And why do we cling so vehemently to our side of the argument? And, you know, I remember it being this way. And the other person says, no, I remember it being this way. And we're like, no, you're wrong. And my memory is better than your memory. You know, all the stupid arguments that we have that really just are a waste of time because it's two people arguing over something that's not tangible and that's past. So a parigraha also sort of steps us into that realm. And one of the really beautiful things that happens with the parigraha is, you know, as I talked about with the gentle, it was a gentleman doing the Hajj that was talking about here, but this idea that you go around and you ask for forgiveness from everyone who you think you've hurt. But also a parigraha really sort of asks you to let go of your own resentments. Like if you are clinging on to resentment about people, then you are not practicing a parigraha. And so it sort of says, you know, step up, write the letters, maybe you don't send them, that you need to write forgiveness. Do the rituals that you need to do. Work through as much as you can at your own pace. But forgive, really, really let go of resentments, because they're like that trap. They're like the monkey with the banana who won't let go of it and therefore is trapped outside the cage with a banana inside. So, a big practice also, as I mentioned, of forgiveness. So it can be nice to, I'm just thinking of sort of some practical things you can do. As I say, think of people who you maybe harbor resentments with. And obviously the big ones come up first and you don't have to tackle those. You can start with the smaller things. Like that, I don't know, the man at the shop who always seems to never look you in the eye. Let's do that one first. Let's write him a letter of forgiveness. Then the other is letting go of your labels. So one thing that Ram Dass talks about, and I think we mentioned this before in the Bhagavad Gita class, is that is to write a list of everything you put the word "my" before, and you'll have like a, you know, a good clue to all the things that you're really holding on to. Or the other thing is to write "I am" and then whatever it fills in with "I am." You know, a journalist, I am a woman, I am blah, blah. And as the list goes on, you begin, there are clues to the things that your mind is clinging to, that your mind has. And, you know, over time, you'll be able to say, oh, I am a journalist, and realize I'm just doing it because that's, you know, easy to communicate with and it's just a word. But there is sometimes we'll say, I'm a teacher, a journalist, or a greengrocer, or I don't know, a cleaner, or whatever it is. Where we feel it, where we can feel that kind of energy of like, yeah, I'm really associated with this particular word of this label of myself. And certainly that sort of plays to, you know, triggering points like, you know, your political persuasion or your gender. So a lot of things can come up just with making a simple list. And then they begin to give you clues of just things you can start to ease out on and explore, really. The more you begin to explore, well, why am I attached to this idea? So those are a couple of things to do when exploring. Let me just see if there's anything else here. Okay. That's it. I have a cup of tea. No, it's not an Eastern teaching, but the best writing I've ever seen with regards to desires and looking at desires is actually in The Way of Mastery and Book One, The Way of the Heart. So I'll just type that in case anyone wants to check that out. I know we cover it in the sanctuary. In lesson four in that book, and it's several pages, it talks about following the thread of desire. And I think it really captures what we're looking to do as we explore this I am this, and this is me, and this is mine, and these are the things I'm clutching onto as we're practicing a parigraha. Because it says that, you know, a lot of the time we just don't talk about our desires because there's a lot of judgment around it, or we don't want to look at what's holding on to us or what's got the grip because it's sort of painful to start to unpack it. But really, it's only if we start to look at them that we can begin to follow the thread down, as the Way of Mastery says, down to what our true desire is. The scribe for Way of the Heart talks about how, you know, how desire is really sacred, and yet we've sort of turned it into something to sort of turn away from. Even it has this hold on us. We just sort of follow randomly our desires and sort of get clung to something, but often we're sort of, because of that restlessness, unable to really look at it and see, hang on a minute, what is it I truly want here? What is it I truly want? And it has this beautiful quote that says, the very act of turning to allow and welcome desire is not something that will sidetrack you from the path of awakening, but will actually take you vertically into the heart of God. So following it back, following the thread of our desire all the way down, we reach this like one true desire. So I just wanted to read a little bit from the Way of Mastery here. So it's a long chapter, so I don't know how clear I'll be, but I do recommend reading it if you're thinking about sort of following this desire. So it talks about sort of imagining that there is a thread that follows all the way down into the depths of the ocean. And if you begin to sort of pull up on that thread and look at some of these desires, look at some of the me and the mine and the resentments and the things that control us and the clinging and the grasping, sort of that outward reaching of, oh, I've got to have it. And sort of when you start observing and allowing yourself to do that, but with this neutral viewpoint, you can begin to see, okay, what's at the bottom of the thread. So you keep pulling the thread up, like, oh, I can see that maybe I'm attached to healthy food at the minute because, in my case, too, I really want to have a baby. And then you pull that up and you say, okay, why do I want to have a baby? Let's look at what my true desire is here. Well, because I want to love something and I want to nurture and create in the world. And you keep on going and pulling that thread up and the thread up. And the scribe says that eventually you will probably, maybe, reach this point where you realize what you truly want is to be at peace. What you truly want is to awaken. And as I mentioned before, to have this like neutrality, to be happy. To just be at one with who you are, to know who you are, to find, you know, be self-realized or find your God self or connect with your higher, whatever those words are for you, that ultimately could be at the very bottom of that thread. And only will you ever find that out by going through this process of all the other stuff first. So whereas the Bhagavad Gita says, you know what, if you've got these desires, you'll keep coming back life after life until they're fulfilled. What the Way of Mastery says is, great, that this is, you know, that may or may not be true. I don't know if they agree on that point. But what you can do is to take a good list of desires, really, just look at every single one, and they're everywhere. They're absolutely, like, every thought has some sort of clinging or avoidance to it, you know, and just looking at them, and what's below that, and what's below that, and what's below that, and then ultimately you'll pull it all up. So you may save yourself lifetimes by doing this really lovely exercise. Let me see if what he says here. Okay. Right, so if you arrive at home, it will mean you have had to give up being a seeker. you will have had to become one who is found. And you'll have to have given up all your identity with smallness. And he says, desire can be a lot of fun. So it's something you can practice with a friend. Okay. And then you will know peace and joy. So, you know, and with the new year, this is approaching. It was a time where we all sort of kind of sit down and maybe do a review of the past year and think about the year ahead. This kind of exercise can be really great. Or alternatively, we can be start sort of think about what is the deep desire of my heart? And if we already know, we don't need these clues by looking at everything else. We can just start to write down the deep desire of my heart is, the deep desire of my heart is this. And also sort of meditate on it and see what really is lies under all the other stuff that we're doing. Kind of just sort of to distract ourselves, really. Again, this restless mind. So that I recommend as a nice practice. Let me have a look what else we've got here. Really like the universe wants to help us fulfill our desires. But the book says, you know, it's like a vision board, someone points out you could do for the new year. The universe wants to help fulfill its desires, but it has been confused. While we have been pushing down some desires, how could the universe know to support us with our one true one? And I love this idea, and this is purely in the way of the heart, the way of mastery, that this idea that, you know, how confusing it is that we're like, oh, I really want this, but I shouldn't want it. Or, you know, I feel like I, you know, want to be with more than one partner, but I shouldn't. I don't want to try that. Or I want to be with someone who is with multiple partners and give that a go. And then, oh, but I shouldn't. And then ultimately the universe says, well, hang on a minute. You're also sitting here in meditation saying that you want to be self-realized or know God or whatever it is that you use. Do you or don't you? Because, you know, which one is it here? You have these desires, you say you want things, then you push them down. So the point the scribe makes in the way of the heart is that just accept it all. Just observe your desires and welcome them in, observe them, and you'll probably realize that, no, actually, I don't want 50 lovers. One is fine. But just by looking at it, you begin observing it, you begin to sort of break that away. And then the universe can sort of come into alignment with you, like heaven and earth move to your side and say, okay, now you're clear on what you want. Off we go. So when we start to, as I say, look at these desires with innocence and wonder, really, we can begin to discern which is coming from our own divinity and which comes from this restless mind. And as I say, it can be often a physical feeling. So one will feel restrictive and clinging, and you'll probably feel your shoulders go up a little bit and you'll be like, oh my God, I have to have this. And one will feel very open and just relaxing almost. And then you can kind of start to feel out, okay, this is the one I should be following. And this one, there seems to be something for me to explore and unpack there. So what are our true desires and which are just habits or even addictions? And rather than feeling we have to suppress them, like I mentioned, we now know that we're safe to let them arise in consciousness. And when we arise, it's like pulling up that thread and just keeping them, pulling it up, pulling on. Eventually we'll pull up the whole anchor and then we'll be free. So in addition to focusing on another one of the practices when we begin to know our true desire, it can kind of keep us on pace of letting go of the other stuff. So it's a really helpful experiment or practice or, you know, meditation to do. And we sort of begin to know ourselves as well when we're doing this practice, when we're looking at all this stuff. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you think, oh, I thought I was a person who wanted X, Y, Z, and actually I'm a person who just wants peace. I'm a person who's happy with peace. And if you're a real doer and someone who's led your life looking at your, you know, personal achievements or the things, counting the countries where you've been or the number of books you've read, it can come as a real shock to you that actually what you truly want is just peace in your heart. That's it. Just absolute peace. And that can sort of shift then how you are in the outside world. And it's very interesting because then you feel the conflict between your mind and what your spirit wants goes, because you just let spirit guide you in the end. That's, you know, I can't say it enough. It's a really beautiful practice. Okay. Oh, and just one point, you know, desires are, you know, we're supposed to, yoga is very much about enjoying things. It's not like, you know, you should always enjoy what comes your way if you're desiring it. And that's being present. You know, oh, I feel like a banana. I'm really going to enjoy the banana I have and be with it and not be in my head. So it's definitely not about like pushing away desires. Desires are a beautiful thing because they lead right down to this one desire that we all like have inside us. So one of the practices, another practice you can do is obviously meditation. That is the biggest practice of letting go. Joan Halifax, Roshi Joan Halifax, who's a Zen teacher, I once saw her speak, and she says whenever she sits down to meditate, she says to herself, I cross my legs and hope to die. Because that's where we're going in meditation. We're hoping to get rid of the me and the mine and be like the sadhus who have, you know, their own funeral, just sort of letting go entirely of self. But when we're in meditation, really what we're practicing is letting go in every single moment. So we see the thoughts arise, or the, you know, the itch that we have on our face, and the dead leg, and we see it all arise. And with meditation, we just practice, you know, observing and letting that go. So, you know, there's all sorts of beautiful metaphors of clouds just passing by on the sky of our mind and just seeing them, observing them go by. Or as Pema Chodron says, whenever a thought comes up, she says, thinking, and lets it go. Just doesn't get attached to it, just observes that she's thinking, lets it go. So we're really practicing all the time in meditation in Parigraha, this observing, not practicing non-clinging, not getting carried away in the thoughts or emotions that are arising, but instead just letting go, letting go. And that can really help us then when we go out into the world of continuing this idea of letting things go. So when things are, you know, arise for us, maybe we're very frustrated at the traffic, or, you know, the line in the supermarket is going really slow, and we can feel this kind of, you know, but I've got to get on, and I need to get going. Then we can just sort of be in that moment and say, oh, I see this arise, and that's it. I'm just watching it arise. There's nothing more. And then we don't go down the rabbit hole. So meditation, big, big, big one. Yes, and very lovely. And coming back to center. And sometimes this is helpful, as I mentioned earlier, when you're out in the world, to have this incentive of once you've tapped into what your one true desire is, which may be to have peace in your heart, then it can make it easier to anchor in. Because when your mind's starting to tell you, you know, I was here before these people who jumped in line, or, you know, I'm sick and tired of this traffic. What is wrong with this city that the infrastructure is so poor? When you catch yourself going down those rabbit holes, you can remember, you know, is my desire to get home fast, or is my desire to have peace? And then having that as a strong anchor and a reminder can really be an incentive to sort of to bring you back into the breath and return to that breath. So, yeah, that acknowledgement of what your true desire, your focus is, can then become like your driver when you're off of the cushion. Another practice could be like placing things on the altar. So I have teacher Jennifer Hadley, and she likes to, whenever something arises for you that you're sort of clinging onto, just mentally say, you know, I'm going to put this on the altar. And you sort of mentally envision yourself just placing whatever you're clinging to on the altar, and then just leaving it there, leaving it in the hands of spirit or God or the angels, whatever word you want to use. And just seeing if you can let go that way. And I'm a big fan of, yeah, Jennifer Hadley, she's great. I'm a big fan of having boxes of like with little slots in the top. So one of the things that I think is obvious too for Parigraha is when you are feeling like there's something you can't let go of, maybe you're clinging to an argument, there are some words that were said 5 days ago, or maybe there's something in your life you're really, it just keeps popping up every now and again that's a real trigger for you. Or whether it's that, you know, you're one of those people who feels like they absolutely have to have that first morning cup of coffee, otherwise it's, you know, all hell breaks loose. Of just writing it down, just writing down whatever that is, and then placing it in a box with this sort of mental or energetic sense of, I'm letting this go. And then I feel like, you know, all the things in that box over a month or over a year, you could feel like you could take them all out, put them in a fire, light them up, and see how much energy was in that. Like, I mean, I'm sure it would just really be a wonderful fire. And then you can actually see how much energy you've saved yourself, how you've allowed yourself to expand and take that energy and use it for your path to awakening or whatever it is that you're serving others, as the Gita would advise you to do, rather than this mental exhaustive energy that we talked about last time as well with this ojas on the things we're clinging to. So that's something sort of, if you're into like, writing things down. And yeah, it's also a lovely thing to do in a year. The things that this year have been holding you back, perhaps, or you've been clinging to this year, what do you want to let go for your year ahead? You could write them all out, put them in a box, set fire to them somewhere safe. That would be another practice. Another one is, and this is my favorite, is embracing the change and beauty in nature. So, you know, we have seasons. You don't see trees like desperately holding on to their leaves before they fall to ground. Like, no, no, for God's sake, I don't want to let go of my leaves. Like, nature is just sort of allows the seasons. And because of that, there is a lot of beauty. So I know some people are like, oh, God, I can't believe winter is coming. And they're desperately clinging on to those last days of autumn. And then winter arrives and they're like, oh, God, I'm just going to try and ride this out for the next 3 months. But actually, like, winter is really beautiful. And if you can begin to sort of soften your sort of ideas of what's right or wrong or what you don't want, try, sort of try new things. That's another part of our paragraph. You can really begin to see, like, beauty, the beauty. And there's so much beauty in winter. Maybe not if you're surrounded by concrete and it's grey and bleak and cold. But there is beauty to be found, like in the snow and the different types of birds that come to your garden, perhaps, when it's winter. And then there's something, I don't know if you know about this, but in Scandinavian countries, I think it's from Denmark in particular, there's something called hygge or hygge. It's H-Y-G-G-E. And it's actually sort of embracing the coziness of winter. So there are, it's sort of mad in the UK at the moment. Everyone's talking about it. Sort of guides for how to sort of really get into winter and recognizing, oh, it's a time for being inside. I'll invite all my friends over and we get to have a lovely dinner together. Or look at me, I get to just sit in with a lovely book and a cup of cocoa. How beautiful. So, it's really sort of, for me, it's just like part of a parigraha in understanding that change is beautiful and that we don't have to cling on to, so tightly to things. Things can arise and we can let go of them. Can I elaborate on hygge?
Sure.
It's really just like an essence, hygge. It's that, and if you look at it, there's furniture that's made in hygge style. But I tend to think, if you think of twinkling lights, a cup of cocoa, a really good book, thick woolen socks, walks in the snow with your dog, or cuddling up with your cat, or, you know, children sleeping, a comfy chair. These are all like having a dinner with old friends, opening a really nice bottle of wine on a winter's night, doing a jigsaw, hearing the crunch of leaves on the ground. This is kind of like the essence of hygge. Or hygge, and then there are different ways of saying it, I guess. I'm failing. and so it's yeah, there's like a coziness, it's a gratitude, as you say, a comfort. And I love this because I don't know about you, but I really struggled with winter a lot and don't like it. And now really just resetting the mind and letting go of this And I even feel it physically in winter. You know, your shoulders are up around your ears and you get really grumpy come February because you just really want it to be over if you're in the northeast or somewhere with long winters. This kind of like reframed my mind on it. It allowed me to see that the real beauty and gift, the wonderful gift of winter. I mean, how lovely. You don't have to do anything. You can just stay in and read books, and that's okay because it's winter. And you can hang twinkly lights and drink lovely, sugary, warm drinks. Or, you know, meditate a lot more as a real gift. So that's something that Prayagraha has to say. So that's why, you know, letting go is really important because you allow like a different mindset and a growth to come in. And as I talked about earlier, you can sort of feel this sort of expansion when you do let go or you try something new or you have a reset of your mindset. And I often think about it as like a fledgling bird. So, you know, like birds are made to fly and they have this, you know, if they were just clinging to this branch, then they wouldn't be able to do what spirit or creation put them here to do, which is to fly. And of course, I'm sure it's terrifying for a tiny bird to launch itself off that first time and it bangs itself around and maybe falls down a bit and gets back up. But, you know, the freedom that it then has when it takes flight, I often think about that when we're thinking about Prayagraha, of just every time we feel our minds closing down on something and beginning to judge or become focused on something, you know, in a restless way, then we can just say, oh, you know, I remember the bird, or let me change my mind, or let me experience something new. Deborah Adele, who writes this lovely book on the yamas and niyamas, talks about this moment that happens for a trapeze artist where they're swinging through the air and they have to let go with one hand to reach for the next trapeze as it comes towards them. And in that moment, something really magical happens because it's like a real faith that grows and like a real personal growth that comes with it as they then move on to the next one. They travel forward on their trapeze. And then Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj has this lovely comment about that moment and what it feels like. And he says, these moments are most desirable, for it means that the soul has cast off its moorings and is sailing for distant places. This is detachment, when the old is over and the new has not yet come. There's nothing to be afraid of. Always just remember the instruction, whatever you come across, go beyond. And I just love this because, you know, it can be a scary practice, the Prayagraha, letting go or changing our minds and embracing something new. There's always that choice we have to make. Am I going to be with my old ways, or am I going to embrace change and let spirit move through me and move towards that? But remember this instruction, whatever you come across, go beyond. And then the final thing I wanted to just mention was that, you know, it's through all these small steps that we take, these steps of letting go of, you know, physical stuff, material stuff, and emotional and thoughts and feelings and opinions, that we really will get to a place where one day we'll let go of the I altogether, where we will become like the sadhus, where we just, you know, can attend our own funeral, or don't even need a funeral, as Sri Swami Satchidananda says. You get to this place, and he calls it a jivanmukta, which means sort of you're living in the world, but you're sort of awakened. And in that sense, you become like the breath. So like the breath moves up, you know, within us and we don't control it, then we become like the breath, where some higher intelligence moves us. It's moving us to do all the things we're doing, but it's not really us. We're just allowing it. And every now and again, we'll become engaged again, just like the way we become engaged with our breath, and sort of begin to control it. But then we go back and then spirit's just moving through us again. It's sort of breathing us. So I just sort of love this idea of a Prayagraha leading you to a place of you just become the breath of spirit because you've let go of everything else. I think that was all of my notes today. If there's any questions on a Parigraha, I can quickly take them. I think we've got about 5 minutes left. We're still talking about Higgy. yeah, it's a great thing. Okay. Well, in that case, if it's good with you, I was just going to play a song to sign us out or end my time here this evening. Okay, I'm going to play a song. So I was going to play something that would have fit more with yoga. And then I was thinking about George Michael, who passed today or last night. And I thought, well, we lost a lot of people this year, not just recording artists, but I know that a lot of people lost people close to him this year. And I thought, well, I think we'll play a song, yeah, sending his family and friends love and light. And everyone who's suffering from grief or missing someone, love and light. So I'm just going to play one of his songs. It's an upbeat one. So, and it's one with Aretha Franklin. So we'll just sign out with that. And I'll bid you farewell at the end. Okay. legendary song. Yeah, thank you all for joining me this evening, and happy onward journey, George. And thank you to all. Hope you have a beautiful week. Look forward to speaking with you in the new year. So namaste. Thanks.